Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's program. I'm Marcus Peter. Today, this 4th of July special episode, we're going to be reflecting on the great blessing that is the United States of America. To begin talking about that blessing, I'd like to draw your attention to a commentary that Father Jeffrey Kirby put out on the National Catholic Register. It's available on National Catholic Register and also on AveMariaRadio.net. And he essentially reminds us that if we want the United States to grow and prosper and continue to be the land of the free and the home of the brave, then we have to adopt a mature sense of freedom and a mature sense of sound morality so that we can fully retrieve the dignified order that has to be established for the flourishing of human liberty. And then we have to ensure that that is put into public practice. As Father Kirby reminds us, freedom is a fragile reality. It's denounced by the fictional character of the Grand Inquisitor in the Russian novel The Brothers Karamazov by Fyodor Dostoevsky. In the disturbing account of the Inquisitor, Christ returns to the earth, works miracles, and gives hope to the people, but he's quickly arrested and scrutinized by the Inquisitor. And the examiner tells Jesus Christ he is no longer needed, and he mocks the freedom that Christ has given humanity and tells the Savior that he has misjudged human nature. Now, this figure of the Inquisitor is an epitome to anything that is an affront to true liberty. And that's what we're going to talk about this hour. In the first segment of this hour, we will talk with Paul Kingle about an attempt at a revisionist history. Unfortunately, there is a movement that all of you are aware of called the 1619 Project, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. And it's attempting to redefine the founding of this nation to the year 1619, which was the landing of the first African-American slaves on the shores of the New World. The fact of the matter is the United States of America, and even though that term, the United States of America, was coined in 1776 with the drafting of the Declaration of Independence. So it would be disingenuous to say that 1619 was the founding of this nation, especially since if we want to talk about when people were landed upon our shores, we really ought to talk about the 1400s, the late 1400s, when after Columbus discovered the New World, we had this great influx of European immigrants. Or we can talk about how shortly thereafter, a number of Slav, literally Caucasian slaves, were brought to our shores. And we talk with Paul Kingo about all of this to recognize the fact that, yes, even in the genesis of our nation, there were original sins. Nonetheless, the principles that undergird the founding of this nation put in place the framework necessary for the eventual fighting of the Civil War that became the bloodiest conflict in United States history, incurring the greatest loss of the local lives, the greatest loss of United States lives. But over and above that, it became a global testimony to just how serious the United States of America was in terms of eradicating any form of chattel slavery and establishing the true equality of the human person, regardless of, in this case especially, race. Then we go on to talk with Dr. Vincent Philip Munoz, who is a political analyst and a professor at Notre Dame, about religious liberty in the American founding, which was a foundational, fundamental principle of the First Amendment. And proper understanding of this, interpreting of this, is crucial for us to understand how to not only enact policy, but interpret it in light of how we ought to live today. Because as I've mentioned before, and we will mention in the following segments, a reductionist view of history only serves to bring about the destruction of all that is good in this nation. Freedom of religion is inherently good, and there's a reason why it's enshrined in the First Amendment of the Constitution. Liberty was bought with a price, and we have an obligation to preserve it. Liberty is an ideal rooted in the very notion of our humanity. It is a natural right. And that's what this great nation is founded upon. We'll talk more on this on the other side. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Many political and social progressives are eager to redefine the United States of America starting not in 1776, which is actually truly and literally when the very title United States of America began, but in the year 1619, before Plymouth Rock and before John Winthrop and the Arbella arrived upon our shores. They want to define the nation by slavery and racism. And it's an atrocious movement, to be sure, to talk to us about the original sin of the United States of America, but also the redeeming qualities of the principles of the founding documents and spirit of the fathers, is Paul Kengor. Paul is no stranger to this program. He's an author and professor of political science at Grove City College and the executive director of the Institute for Faith and Freedom, which is a Grove City College conservative think tank and policy center. Paul, great to have you on the program again.
Well, thank you, Marcus. You're doing a great job stepping up and replacing the irreplaceable great Al Cresta. You know, may he rest in peace. He was such a good guy.
He truly was, and he truly is. He lives on in eternity, and we trust in his intercession as we move forward. But thank you for those kind words. They mean a lot.
Sure.
So, Paul, this just baffles me. As an immigrant, and you know, I don't like sharing this particular part of my history very much because I'm not doing this to claim sympathy from anyone, but my ancestry is laden with the same historical burdens and sins, if you will, of a lot of the African Americans in the United States of America. So on the one hand, I could claim a very personal vested interest in this. But on the other hand, there is no denying the fact that what the United States did in its founding and in its principles and its constitution and its documents brought essentially an end to the global movement of slavery as we know it. There's only 10 nations that practice slavery now. So let's open the conversation there.
Yeah. And by the way, those nations are all non-Western, non-Christian nations. You and I should have a discussion about my last book on the church and slavery, The Worst of Indignities. Mm-hmm. Al and I did a conversation on that. It came out through Emmaus Road Publishing about a year ago. Mm-hmm. And my family, too, has some really interesting history with all of this. In fact, my family, they were never slavers. They were enslaved, at least some of them, on the Italian side. It goes way back. I could talk on and on about that. But as to this point today, yeah, that very title, United States of America, I literally have, Marcus, next to me right now, a copy of the Declaration of Independence. And it says,
as should every good American citizen.
Yeah. I teach it and to be totally candid, every year at this time I get requests to write articles on this, right? Mm. So I just wrote a piece on this for American Spectator, which I'm the editor, and that will run on the July 4th edition. But it's interesting in the text of the Declaration, United is with a lowercase u. So at that point, it's not yet the USA, mm-hmm. right? These are actually truly the United, as in united together, states of America. In fact, in the document, they use an uppercase U when they refer to themselves as the United Colonies of all things. Mm-hmm. So what are they united against? They're united against Great Britain, King George III, and they're declaring independence from them. And you know, but that, you know, that is when this nation began. This whole push today to say that America began in the year 1619, you know, when the first enslaved Africans in Virginia were brought to America. No, we truly began in 1776. And by the way, not to go off on a tangent again about my previous book, but I note in that book the year 1618. There was a book that came out about 10 years ago. And this was this was before the whole 1619 project even began. But the book is called White Cargo.
Mm-hmm,
and it's by two really good scholars. And they focused on the year 1618 because 1618 is actually when the first slaves were brought to America. And they were white slaves.
Yep, exactly.
They were indentured servants from Britain. You know, white people enslaving white people and setting up to America. And, you know, and none of this, of course, in any way is to disregard the horrific experience of Black Americans, which was worse than what the white cargo went through. Although the white cargo, many of them, they were manacled, they were shackled, they were chained, they were whipped, they were auctioned, they were treated very cruelly.
They were murdered. We have historical evidence of that.
Yeah, they were. What's really so bad about slavery is that it has affected all societies in all countries going back thousands of years. And, you know, I don't need to say this to a Christian audience, right? Pick up your Bibles.
Right.
You know, read about the God's chosen people, the Jews. Yeah, they were enslaved thousands of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of this is a way by modern, you know, leftists, progressives, to try to kind of reframe America as this sinister country. But we didn't begin in 1619. We began on July 4th, 1776. Yep. And here's the really crucial point. You know, the tenets, the ideas in that document, right, the idea of the laws of nature and nature's God, that we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, right, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Those principles were established in that document for all human beings.
Yep.
And we weren't able to extend them to the slaves yet at that time, but we put in place the principles that Abraham Lincoln, you know, 67 years later, 1865, said, you know, that nation conceived in liberty. So Lincoln is able to pick up those principles, put them into place, but not without a civil war. What really makes America so unique is that we fought a civil war to establish those principles for all Americans, including Black people. And it was the bloodiest war in the history of our country. To this day, you have to add up all the other wars combined.
Yes.
World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Gulf War, everything, to start to get close to equating to the total number of Americans who died in the Civil War. It was our bloodiest war in history, and that was done in order to free the slaves.
Mm-hmm.
So we paid the price, and it's really a kind of pretty unbelievably noble thing.
Yes.
That we did what we did to free Black Americans from slavery.
Yep, and that's why the 1619 movement, the whole project, is so bigoted. Because going back to this question of the Civil War, the vast majority of blood that was spilled were from white. They were white people, and I'm not trying to be racist about this, but it's a demonstration of the fact that the undergirding principles of this nation, the founding of the equality of all human persons, from its get-go led to eventually what became the Civil War. You take a look at Britain and the rest of Europe and the abolishment of slavery, it didn't entail as much bloodshed as it did here in the United States. What happened with the Civil War changed the direction of global history when it came to... So just like you, my ancestors were bought and sold as slaves, and I think it was well into the late 18th century before this kind of emancipation began to happen with the British Commonwealth. But the fact of the matter is, the undergirding principles of this nation and its constitution is what led to the equality of persons, what led to eventually the Civil War, that eventually begot the freedoms that we have now in the Civil Rights Act and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and in fact, in my family history, so my mom's side, Italian, from Calabria in Italy, you know, they were constantly facing enslavement, threats of enslavement from the Muslim Turks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Battle of Lepanto, Knights of Malta.
Right.
I mean, those battles protected them. Some of them probably were taken off into the Middle East. Some of them probably as Janissaries, you know, forced to convert to Islam.
Mm-hmm.
My dad's side, Ken Gore is Polish, and the word slaves comes from
Slav. Yep.
Latin, Slavs. The Slavs were slaves in Eastern Europe. Now, my only ancestors who actually lived in America at the time of the Civil War, that was on my dad's side, too. They were the Flynns. They were from West Virginia, and they fought for the North in the Civil War. So they fought and died to free Black slaves, right? So, that, you know, this is all very, very complicated how all of this works. And by the way, I should point out, too, that slavery did continue to exist in America after the Emancipation Proclamation.
Mm-hmm.
Really? Where? Among American Indians.
Yep.
Among Native Americans, the five so-called civilized tribes, the Choctaw, the Cherokee, the Iroquois, they all owned black African, black American slaves
mm-hmm.
into the late 1800s. They still had slavery on the Indian reservations, and they were manacled, shackled. They cut they would cut the foot off of an escaped slave
right.
that they caught to bring him back to teach him a lesson. There are to this day lawsuits by black Americans against Native American tribes. Joe Biden's not going to talk about this during Indigenous Peoples Day, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're going to focus on Christopher Columbus, right?
Right.
But the Indigenous peoples enslaved one another, killed one another, and also enslaved black Americans. And they did it until the late 1800s, all right? This is history we don't know, because people in things like the egregious 1619 Project want to reframe this in a way that fits their ideological agenda to try to reframe America in a narrative that works better for them and their kind of progressive reconstruction of American history.
That's right. And so we have just under a minute, Paul. Slavery was America's original sin, but it wasn't unique to America. There are so many things that are redeeming about the great American experiment. So let's end on a hopeful note of encouragement and exhortation here.
Yeah, and I would add, too, and maybe you guys could post the piece I wrote on this for National Catholic Register a couple years ago. All of the leading American founders were all actually against slavery
mm-hmm.
and acknowledged that it was wrong and evil. Even the ones that owned slaves, like Washington and Jefferson,
right.
I quote them in that article, right? The problem was finding a way to end it. And unfortunately, that would take another few generations, including the Civil War, for it to be ended. But end it we did. And that's something great about America that should be celebrated rather than used to denigrate the country and its founding.
That's right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Paul. Always a joy to speak with you. And as we celebrate the Independence Day of our nation, the true founding of our nation, 4th of July, 1776, let's continue to be grateful to our Lord for all that we have been given in this blessed land we call the United States of America. My guest has been Paul Kengor, author and professor of political science at Grove City College and executive director of the Institute for Faith and Freedom, which is a conservative think tank and policy center. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Man failed the first test of freedom. He refused God's plan of love and chose freely to sin and made himself a slave to sin. That first sin gave mankind the gene or inclination to sin, which has given birth to numerous other sins. The Catholic Catechism reminds us that the exercise of freedom does not imply a right to say or do everything. Man is not totally self-sufficient, and his final goal is not his own self-interest and the enjoyment of earthly goals. When man violates the moral law, he becomes his own prisoner, disrupting neighborly fellowships while rebelling against divine truth. For freedom, Galatians tells us, Christ has set us free. He redeemed us from sin, which held man in bondage. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Christ is the answer, with Father John Ricardo.
John 14. This is Jesus in the upper room with the disciples before he's going out to his sacrifice of himself for our salvation. And Philip says to the Lord, "Show us the Father, and we'll be satisfied." Jesus looks at Philip and says, "Philip, have I been with you all this time? Don't you understand? When you see me, you're looking at the Father." In fact, only two people throughout human history have given rise to the question, not who is he, but what is he? The two people are Buddha and Jesus. Buddha's answer was, don't come to me, don't look to me, look to my doctrine, look to what I teach. Jesus's answer was, come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble of heart. Jesus is explicitly claiming to be God.
He was a pope, a saint, and a doctor of the church.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
Pope St. Gregory I the Great is one of only four popes honored as the Great. Among his many achievements was sending missionaries across Northern Europe, especially St. Augustine of Canterbury, who brought Christ to the people of England. In a pun, Pope Gregory called the English people angels. He died in 604.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes, without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
Support for this Ave Maria radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. The religion clauses in the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights are among the most hotly debated topics in constitutional law and history. Unfortunately, the records of the founders don't always offer the best help in terms of interpreting or even elucidating what they meant by it. Vincent Munoz's lucid Religious Liberty and the American Founding, Natural Rights and the Original Meanings of the First Amendment Religion Clauses, is perhaps one of the best treatments we have on the meaning of these clauses. And we're engaging him today because it's so crucial that we learn to consider the sheer blessing it is of having religious freedom as one of the founding principles of this nation. Vincent Munoz is an American political scientist. He is the Tocqueville Professor in the Department of Political Science and concurrent professor of law at the University of Notre Dame. Vincent, it's great to have you in the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, the joy is all ours. I'd like to launch right into this because there's so much to talk about and very little time to do it. When you talk about the right to religious expression and religious liberty, this is something that's ingrained in natural law, and the founding fathers seem to have an understanding of that principle. This is something endowed by our Creator upon man by virtue of him being a creature of liberty.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. The founders, when they talked about religious liberty, they talked about it as a natural right. In fact, they talked about it as an inalienable right.
Mm-hmm.
What they meant by natural right was it's a right that we have religious liberty not because the government grants us that right, but because of our nature as creatures, that is, beings who are created by a God, and therefore we have obligations that pre-exist, or in fact are more important than any obligations we have to the state. So our right of religious liberty inheres in our human nature,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that we are created by God and ordained to worship him.
Right. Now, Vincent, when we talk about rights as they are enshrined, particularly in the Constitution, one of the things that we go back to is exactly what you said, the notion of a natural right, which means that these are rights endowed by a force, a creator, an authority that's beyond the democratic government. And as such, every individual is owed that right by virtue of God having created them to be the way they are.
Yeah, that's right. Madison, James Madison, who probably had more to do with writing the Bill of Rights than in the Constitution than any other individual, in one of his most profound documents, it's called the Memorial and Remonstrance Against Religious Assessments. It's from 1785. He writes, I'm paraphrasing here, we have rights among men because we have duties to God.
Mm-hmm.
It's important to note that to say that that one has a right to religious liberty, it doesn't mean that the state is neutral or indifferent to religion, but rather that we have certain obligations to the Creator, and that those obligations and the space and freedom to fulfill those obligations in the way that's proper to human freedom requires that the state give us room to act as we believe, to worship as we think we ought to worship. So I just want to anticipate a mistake that many people will say. Many people will say, well, look, there's no right to religious liberty. You have an obligation to worship. And the founder's thinking, and this is the church is thinking too, I believe, we have political rights to worship. That is, the government can't coerce us or worship because we have obligations to God.
Right.
We have an obligation to worship freely. That requires the political authorities to give us the space to fulfill that obligation.
Mm-hmm.
The state can't make us worship properly. That has to be a movement of the heart and conscience, ultimately derived from love of God, and love of God has to be freely given. And therefore, our duty to worship God creates a political right among men to do so freely.
Right. And I'm glad you brought up Madison, because of all of the founders, he's the one who gives us the clearest idea of the notion of a social compact when it comes to consent of the people of liberty and the ends of governmental authority and governmental reach when it comes to the expression of religion, freedom of religion.
That's right. And consent is a necessary condition of legitimate government.
Mm-hmm.
Government cannot be imposed on it. But it's only a necessary condition. It's not a sufficient condition. What makes government legitimate is consent, and also that government is ordained to its proper ends, to securing justice, to criminal law, protection of property. One of the ends of government, one of the ends that's not proper to government, according to the founders at least, is the exercising of religious authority.
Mm-hmm.
Government can't license preachers. Government can't have official tenets of this is the correct religion or this is the incorrect religion. Government can't appoint bishops. And the reason why is not because government is indifferent to religion. The reason why government doesn't have authority is because that authority has been given to the church.
Right.
We limit government out of respect for the due authority of the church, and that the church's authority comes from God. So, again, this is another mistake people make. People think limited government or the separation of church and state means indifference or even hostility to religion. No, not at all. The limiting government authority and separation of church and state is in part to recognize the actual due authority of the church to the more sovereign and more supreme authority of the church over directing our religious obligations. So we limit the state in order to recognize the legitimate authority of the church.
That's right. And in doing so, we also give the state its due place in the exercise of its own rightful authority.
That's correct, right? That Christ says, give to Caesar what is Caesar's, give to God what is God's. So Caesar does have, the state does have legitimate authority. I mean, Christianity and Catholicism is not anarchical or anti-government. It's just that the legitimate power of government is in its own limited proper sphere.
Right. And at the level of the citizenry, then, just applying those exact principles in terms of the limitation and boundaries of authority, there also exists a natural boundary for the exercise of natural right when it comes to religious freedom.
Yeah. The way I like to put it is all rights, including natural rights, have natural limits.
Mm-hmm.
And we all understand this. Intuitively, actually. The right for me to control my body and move my hands, walk around, it doesn't mean I can, ball my hand up into a fist and punch you. Right? The right, it's 4th of July, about to be 4th of July weekend here. So the right to use my backyard for a barbecue, for fireworks, doesn't mean the right to use my backyard in such a way that it creates a perpetual nuisance to my neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's foul smells or being too loud past quiet hours. I mean, maybe there's no quiet hours in the 4th of July, but, on a regular Tuesday or Thursday or what have you. So all natural rights have natural limits. So the right to worship, which is one of our fundamental rights, doesn't mean you can do anything. It doesn't mean you can sacrifice young children, to take an actual historical example of some religions. Natural rights are limited by the natural law.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, if I can push this, it's because God is both the God of faith and reason.
Right.
God is not going to command us to sacrifice children. We have this from the Old Testament. When God does command this, he stops it. And so because we have faith in the harmony of faith and reason, we can understand that natural rights are limited by the natural law, and the natural law is just the law of reason.
Right. I mean, you consider the preamble of the Declaration, for example, you'll realize that this notion of the natural law and to some degree the limitation of natural right is ingrained in the minds of the founding fathers and their philosophy. The preamble sets a separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitle them, which means on the one hand we respect the endowing of these rights, but on the other hand we also respect the due limitations of these rights where appropriate.
Yes, and the very fact that rights are bounded, and that's why we need government in part to coordinate the exercise and enjoyment of our rights.
Mm-hmm.
We all have a right to acquire property, but there are due limits on the acquisition of property. You have to leave enough for others. God gives the world to us in common, so I can't pollute all the air or fish all the fish. And we need government to protect the commons, and so we can all exercise our natural rights together in community.
In understanding that, then, we also have to acknowledge that not all the founders saw eye to eye in terms of the disestablishment between church and state. In fact, one might argue that the most significant of their disagreements most probably came to the notion of taxation with regard to the support of religious institutions. But ultimately, everything got squared away with regard to preserving the right of the church, as you mentioned earlier, to be sovereign over the morality of the people.
Yeah, that's right. So what I say, the way I like to put it, is that the founders agreed on first principles. They agreed mm-hmm. that religious liberty is a natural right. They agreed on the most basic fundamentals. They disagreed the further you got away from those principles, when you got into applications, specific applications of those principles, then you start to see disagreement. For students of Thomas Aquinas and the natural law, Thomas himself says, the further you get away from the primary precepts of the natural law, the more things are subject to judgment, and therefore the more disagreement you'll have. So this is not even foreign to Thomistic thinking. So one of the areas of disagreement was on taxpayer funding of churches. Some founders thought, no, it's legitimate for the government to support churches. And the basic reasoning is not that complicated, actually. Churches were the primary teachers of morality mm-hmm. at the time, and the primary educators. So there wasn't a widespread school of public education, or most education happened through churches. We need an educated population. We need a moral population. And so the argument goes that government can support religion because religion supports the citizen character, the moral character necessary for a self-governing people.
Mm-hmm.
Perfectly reasonable argument.
Right. We're going to
continue.
Sorry, Vincent. So we're hitting a hard break, but we're going to continue this conversation with Vincent Munoz, who is an American political scientist, the Tocqueville Professor in the Department of Political Science and concurrent professor of law at the University of Notre Dame. And we are talking about religious liberty and the American founding. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Do you have a teenager at home who's full of potential? Too often the world is telling you to be content with mediocrity instead of raising respectful and responsible young adults with strong character. Hi, everybody. I'm Dr. Ray. If you need some help, not only to navigate those teen years, but to really enjoy them, check out my book, Standing Strong, Good Discipline Makes Great Teens, as well as my other books on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com. This program brought to you in part by the town of Ave Maria, Florida.
Ave Maria, a big kind of small town. A golf cart friendly, ride your bike everywhere kind of town with something for everyone. Resort style amenities, two golf courses, shopping, and dining in our town center. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at the core of the community and a wide range of homes to meet your family's needs. Visitors are welcome. More information can be found at AveMaria.com. Ave Maria, a big kind of small town.
The Catholic Church teaches that Jesus Christ is literally and wholly present, body and blood, soul and divinity, under the appearances of bread and wine. Feeding 5,000 from a boy's five barley loaves and two fish, as recorded in John chapter 6, is quite a miracle. Yet the next day, Jesus downplays it in verse 27. Do not work for the food that perishes, but for the food that endures for eternal life, which the Son of Man will give you. Likewise, God's provision of manna to the Israelites in the desert was also a great miracle, yet Jesus similarly downplays it in verse 49. Your ancestors ate the manna in the wilderness, but they died. This is the bread that comes down from heaven, so that one may eat of it and not die. Jesus is clearly stating that his Eucharist is greater than both of these amazing miracles, and the Catholic Church absolutely takes him at his word. Examining the truths of the Catholic faith, this is faithforensics.org.
Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo.
The Church isn't saying throw out the baby with the bathwater. Throw out all the media. Don't use the media. What the Pope is saying, that make sure that what you are doing is enabling yourself and others to encounter Christ more deeply. And you can't do that unless you reach out. You have to reach out to God first. You have to encounter him in the Eucharist, in that personal relationship. And then you pray, you reflect, and then you go. In my book, Beyond Sunday, Becoming a 24/7 Catholic, I talk about the three M's of faith: meeting, mercy, and mission. You meet and encounter Christ. You enter into a personal relationship with him. He gives you mercy. And then what do? You just sit there and say, oh, thanks, Jesus. See you later. No, you go out on mission exactly as the woman at the well did.
Catholic Connections, Teresa Tomeo. Weekdays, 9 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. We're talking about religious liberty and the American founding. We're talking about how natural rights and the original meaning of the First Amendment religion clauses need to be passed out, especially in the minds of the founders. And my guest to help us navigate this question is Vincent Philip Munoz, American political scientist, Tocqueville professor in the Department of Political Science, and concurrent professor of law at the University of Notre Dame. Now, Vincent, we talked earlier about you were cut off at the break, so let's pick up where we left off there.
Sure. I was saying how the founders disagreed on some of the applications of the natural law and natural right principles of the founding. So I was saying that some founders thought that it was inappropriate for government to support religion through taxpayer funds because religion helped cultivate the character, the moral character necessary for good citizenship. But other founders thought, well, obviously we need moral character and we need good citizens. But founders like James Madison thought, religion doesn't need the support of government to flourish.
Right.
It may be true that religion cultivates morality, but government funding of religion doesn't cultivate good religion, was his argument.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the easiest way for us to understand this today is the way we think about public schools. I think everyone agrees that we need schools and children need education and schooling.
Mm-hmm.
How we do that, though, is a debatable question.
That's right.
Certainly, we can fund government-run schools, and I mean, I went to public schools, government-run schools myself. But there is an argument, and a worthwhile argument, that look, actually, state-run schools, government-run schools, actually aren't great schools.
Yeah.
That it would be better to cut off that funding or to fund parents or to fund differently.
Right.
And that was Madison's point. Madison's point was, you know, once churches are funded directly by government, government tends to have a very bad influence over those churches.
Mm-hmm.
Government starts to want to regulate churches, exercise power over those churches. We see this with charity today. You know, once government funds the charity, even Catholic charities, it starts putting restrictions on those charities. Or you could look comparatively, look at the situation of the church in Germany, which is not the Catholic Church in Germany, which does receive funds from the state. And there's a very good argument to make that Madison was right, actually, that religion exists in greater purity without the aid of government than
right.
with the aid of government. But that's a debatable question, and we debate it today, and the founders debated it then. So, but this disagreement was on sort of secondary applications of principles, not on the principles themselves.
That's right. So even when you see the tension, if you will, between expansive liberalism versus narrow republicanism, what you're seeing here is a passing out of, first of all, the agreement of the first principle, but in terms of the application and the role of government in enabling the application of that first principle.
I think that's exactly right? That to put it in our language, they disagreed about public policy,
mm-hmm.
even though they agreed about the same fundamental purposes or ends of government.
Right. So moving forward from there, then, when we talk about this notion of the establishment of the natural right in the public sphere, it's not like this was a settled question. In fact, this is one of those things that to this very day continues in discussion, especially up to the highest level of government.
Yeah, I think so. Though, I mean, because we have so many disputes about so many different church-state issues,
yeah.
Sometimes we overlook areas that have been settled, thankfully. I mean, there are almost no instances of a state or a government trying to punish someone for going to church or for failing to go to church.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we just don't do that. We don't have mandatory church attendance laws. We don't say you have to go to that church or
That's right.
you have to believe these religious things. We don't have the state trying to appoint bishops, a very common practice in the history of Western government. So we have settled many things and many dramatic and important things. Doesn't mean we've settled all our questions. We certainly haven't. But I think sometimes we lose sight of how we've taken some big and major questions off the table. That there is a proper separation of church and state, again, to preserve the church's own autonomy
mm-hmm.
and its own authority. And thankfully, we live in a country that, for the most part, gets the most significant questions right.
Right.
We disagree on all, not my, I don't want to say they're minor questions, but we're certainly not, when we elect a president, we're not worried about whether this president will, how that president will try to influence who the Archbishop of Philadelphia will be, or the Archbishop mm-hmm. of New York, or your local bishop. And that's a very good thing, to separate politics and religion in that way.
So then going back to this question of the Establishment Clause, then how should the American today, at the very least, all of our listeners right now, in understanding the First Amendment and the natural right, how should the Establishment Clause be understood in light of, say, the conflict between Madison and Henry?
Yeah, Patrick Henry you're referring to.
Yep.
Well, that's a very big question. it takes me about four weeks to answer it when I teach the subject at Notre Dame.
You have 7 minutes.
Let me give you a couple broad outlines. First of all, there's a line of jurisprudence. Maybe some of the listeners are familiar with it. It started in 1947, and it's sort of the wall of separation mm-hmm. jurisprudence. And that means that religious groups can't participate in public programs, and it, in many instances, counseled discrimination against religion, or the government can't endorse religion or put up, religious displays around Christmas time in the public square.
Right.
I think all of that was mistaken, at least from a historical originalist perspective. That was never the original meaning of the Constitution. The Constitution never meant to counsel discrimination against religious individuals or mm-hmm. religion in the public square. And those were excessive, misguided interpretations done by the Supreme Court. And the recent court has really restrained and actually overturned some of those egregious precedents.
Mm-hmm.
Just a historical footnote on that. A lot of these original precedents, they weren't anti-religious per se. They were actually anti-Catholic. These were at a time when Catholics were growing in population in America. Catholic schools were becoming more and more prominent.
Mm-hmm.
And the Supreme Court, unfortunately, it's an ugly part of our history, wanted to prevent public dollars from going to Catholic schools. And that's what led to the wall of separation jurisprudence. But thankfully, that sordid history, which was implemented in our fundamental law, has been repealed in large amounts.
Right.
That's only half. So that's to say what the Establishment Clause should not mean.
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean? Well, that's a complicated question that the court has struggled with. I have my own answer to that, and it means at least this. It means that the state can't act like a church.
Mm-hmm.
The state can't have official creeds, religious creeds, and the state can't delegate its authority to the church. What do I mean by that? In a historical establishment, churches would tax their members, and these taxes were not simply voluntary contributions. The church would impose a tax on its members. And if you didn't pay the tax, the church had the authority of the state to collect the tax from you. So it was the state delegating its coercive power to the church. That's an establishment of religion, and that can't and should not be done. So the
right.
state can't delegate its authority to the church. And again, that's to respect the proper spheres of church and state. One of the great teachings about by John Paul II and by Benedict the 16th, I think, were to recognize that the church in its purity doesn't actually need the coercive power of the state. The church is a moral teacher and compels us through love, not by force. And I think that is actually the teaching of Dignitas Humanae. That's mm-hmm. the teaching, historical teaching of the Catholic Church, which, of course, at the very beginning was persecuted by the state. And I think that's also consonant with the founders' understanding, the understanding
right.
of our Constitution.
Right, and I'd agree with you genuinely. So then to take this a step further, how would you go about talking about constructing First Amendment principles in light of natural rights for religious free exercise? And, you go to great lengths critiquing and examining the question of originalism in that manner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think, again, let's start with the fundamentals. The most fundamental thing the First Amendment protects, the
protects the free exercise of religion. Mm-hmm. It means you cannot be punished for the church you go to on Saturday or Sunday. Mm-hmm. And you cannot be punished if you don't go to church. Right. No, you know, I think you ought to go to church, but that's not the business of the state. Right? That when we talk about limited government, that's the fundamental limit. The state is not to declare which is the correct church, and it's not to coerce you to go to church through fines or prison terms or anything like mm-hmm. that. That's just not the proper role of government. So that's the, in a way, the most essential right of free exercise.
Mm-hmm.
I will say we did run into this problem during the COVID-19 mm-hmm. pandemic. There were some, I'm from Seattle originally, and the governor of Washington actually passed a regulation, an executive order that regulated how communion was to be distributed in religious services, including the Mass. And that was just inappropriate. It's not the role of the governor to tell you how communion ought to be distributed. I mean, you can make general rules for, you know, distribution of food or even of gatherings, but you can't make specific regulations on how communion is to be distributed.
That's right. That's right.
Even during a pandemic, that's not an authority that we give to government. So that's the most fundamental thing the Free Exercise Clause protects.
So,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. Go on, please.
Well, I was going to say then on secondary things. You know, are religious citizens to be exempt from laws that they find religiously burdensome? My argument there is that no, that's not a constitutional right. That's a legislative grace.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where a lot of the burdens on religions are today: administrative rules and laws, especially non-discrimination laws. Now religious citizens can be exempt from those laws, but I don't believe that religious citizens have a right to be exempt from those laws. And I think if religious citizens find these general laws burdensome, then we ought to really think about, well, do we really need these laws in the first place?
Right.
I think the general principle is, look, if you can't apply a law without oppressing people, a large number of people, maybe there's something wrong with the law itself. And I think that's a lesson that the equal application of the law is a check against the passing unjust laws.
That's right. That's right. In fact, that was going to be my question, that the equal application of the law, if it flies in the face of and becomes an affront to natural right, then we do have a problem in terms of the justness of the law.
That's right. That's right. You know, and unjust laws are going to lead to oppression. And the solution to unjust laws is not to have targeted exemptions, but to not have those laws at all.
Right. Thank you so much for joining us, Vincent. This has been a truly enlightening conversation. My guest has been Vincent Philip Munoz, American political scientist, Tocqueville professor in the Department of Political Science and concurrent professor of law at the University of Notre Dame. He's also the author of Religious Liberty and the American Founding. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
The following program is brought to you in part by MyCatholicWill.com. Surveys show that more than half of Americans do not have a will. At MyCatholicWill.com, it takes as little as 15 minutes to write your will and secure a legacy of faith. MyCatholicWill.com is the exclusive online destination for creating a Catholic will. The process of writing a will is simple, and now more accessible than ever. MyCatholicWill.com, a legacy of faith for those you love.
Living the Beatitudes with Father Bjorn.
Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Saint Jose Maria Escriva says that we are called to light up the pathways of this earth by being sowers of peace and joy. This comes from being aware that we are sons and daughters of God. On the road of life, though, we find dangers. But God walks with us every step of our life, pouring out the gifts of His Holy Spirit upon us. Our Lady is our companion, like GPS in our car, connected to the cloud and bringing the latest updates to help us navigate our journey and get out of traffic on the way to the eternal kingdom. We don't want to get into family fights on our way to God's vacation destination, but we should be the sowers of peace and joy. We shouldn't accept substitutes, accept only the authentic identity of being His children, His sons and daughters. Let's grow in happiness and bring peace to those around us. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God.
For more about the Beatitudes, visit EWTNRC.com.
When I was outside of the church, there was always an unsettled feeling. There was always a feeling of something missing and something not complete. The deal clincher is we found our way to our parish, and we met just an incredible pastor. We learned things that we'd never been taught. Wouldn't be the person that I am without the church and without the sacraments, particularly the Eucharist. I can't live without it.
If you've been away from the Catholic Church, visit CatholicsComeHome.org.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. We can only truly call ourselves living in a state of liberty when we are made free from arbitrary political restriction, not just in terms of speech and expression of our views, but the raising of our children, the expression of our faith, in accordance with the values that we have deemed by means of our reason to be most beneficial to the flourishing of our first society, our family, ourselves and our family. We are only in liberty when we can enter into voluntary relationships that are contractual, that are mutually agreeable. Any form of coercion on the other side means that that is an affront to our liberty, properly speaking. So the purpose of government is to protect the individual, to allow them the right to choose lifestyles based on moral good. Any affront to the ability to choose moral good is the problem. God bless the United States of America. I'm Marcus Peter.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio, and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.